Hey everybody, it's Off The Ball, it's Gerry Gilroy here. Now before you dive into this podcast, let me tell you that William Hill have decided racing needed a bit of a shake-up. So they brought in the new Racing Bet Builder. It lets you combine multiple picks from the same race into one personalised bet. Basically more options, more control and fewer excuses if your mate's bet beats yours. Pick top three finishes, go head-to-head or call exact positions all in a single bet. It's racing from a new angle and it's live now with William Hill. Get the app, start building your bet today. It's over 18s only. Gamble responsibly. Visit gamblingcare.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Football on Off The Ball.
My fan head is running away from me. I have Arsenal winning the league, but the pundit had on me says that big blue machine that is just reading down Arsenal's neck.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off The Ball Daily.
Good evening and welcome along to Monday night's Off The Ball. It's Owen here with you until 10 o'clock this evening, and it has been a huge day in the world of football. So first of all, shortly after 10 a.m, Manchester United get the ball rolling. They release a statement online. Ruben Amorim has got the bullet. He's self-promoted from head coach to manager over the course of the weekend, and our hierarchy were like, we're not having that. Not to be outdone, Celtic then releases a statement shortly after 3 p.m. They wanted to get in on the action here a little bit. It's after 33 days, so long, good luck to you, Wilfred Nancy. They're going to dominate tonight's show, these two stories, I think it's fair to say. And it's a bumper football show coming up from 9 o'clock. We're going to have Jamie Jackson with us talking Manchester United. He was in the press conferences, the now famous press conferences around the game at Elland Road over the course of the weekend, was asking the key questions where I guess Ruben Amorim was forced to dig his own grave over the course of the weekend. So it'll be interesting to chat to Jamie Jackson. And then Tom English at the BBC will talk all things Celtic as well between 9 and 10. From 8 to 9, we're going to have a wrap up of the URC festive fixtures. It's going to be Liam Toland and Fiona Hayes on Monday Night Rugby, and it's a bumper news round coming in the first hour between 7 and 8. Will O'Callaghan is here to deliver that. Happy New Year, Will.
Happy New Year. Welcome to Sack Day. I got a push notification literally before we came in with Nottingham Forest, and I thought, tell me Dyche is not gone just before we start. No, they've got permission to upgrade the City Ground. I was like, I'm not sure that really justified a push notification on the day.
They knew what they were doing.
No, any other day it might nudge its way onto your news round. Michael McCarthy, Happy New Year to you.
HYN.
It's good to know that. HYN. It's good to know that.
Oh, wait, backwards. Happy Year New.
All the letters were correct. The order was very much incorrect. It is good to know that the powers that be in football do take days off, and that they have also waited till the 5th of January to do something meaningful.
It could be that, or the World Cup, where's it going to be this summer?
It's going to be in the United States.
I feel it might be only in
Canada and Mexico.
Football is, you know, obviously, it's trying to spread its seed. It's trying to go as deep into the trenches of American life. For example, what's the biggest sport in America?
It would be American football, Mick.
And what day is today?
Today's Monday, Mick.
And what colour Monday is it?
Blue Monday.
It's Black Monday.
Oh, it's been all the coaches get sacked.
It's Black Monday. The regular season ended last week, and today is the day when they sack all the coaches in the NFL. Four of them have gone. Three, technically. One was actually sacked last night. They didn't even wait. He won three games at the end of the season. They were like, you're not even leaving the stadium, buddy. You're done. But three more were sacked today. And this is a traditional holiday almost in America, where teams get hope because their coaches get fired as they move into the off season. But of course, football isn't going to be anybody's, you know, it isn't going to take the backseat to anybody these days. So what did they do? Biggest club in the world, one of them, top three, you know, sacked their manager out of nowhere. And then obviously one of the, I don't know what way to describe Celtic without getting in trouble here. But massive club, former European Cup winners, etc. Massive fan base, sacked their manager as well. So look, this is what it's all about.
And of course,
making sure football stays on top of the headlines all over the world.
Like the other sacking or, you know, departure news from the Premier League involving Enzo Maresca, under the most American of all the people, happens before Black Monday. So, there are holes in your theory, Mick, but I like it all the same. I like it. Will, do you want to actually kick us off here and give us the actual information that we have, today's news for anybody who's driving home? We may not be paying full attention all day to the Ruben Amorim story. What has gone down at Old Trafford?
Look, 14 months in charge. You said he maybe dug his own grave. I wonder whether his press conferences, both at the tail end of last week and also after the Leeds game, were very calculated, that he knew this was what the final result was going to be. The club sacking their head coach, as they're very careful to point out after comments he made, criticising the owners after their 1-1 draw at Leeds yesterday. There have been reports in recent days as well that Ineos' members had questioned Amorim's tactical approach, particularly after the game against Wolves over the festive period when he returned to three at the back, and that his relationship had become particularly fraught with Director of Football Jason Wilcox. Amorim spoke about his frustrations about his lack of control over football affairs at Old Trafford after yesterday's game at Elland Road.
I came here to be the manager of Manchester United, not to be the coach of Manchester United. And that is clear. I know that my name is not Tuchel, is not Conte, is not Mourinho, but I'm the manager of Manchester United. And it's going to be like this for 18 months or when the board decided to change. So that was my point. I want to finish with that. I'm not going to quit. I will do my job until other guy is coming here to replace me. I just want to say that I'm going to be the manager of this team, not just the coach. And I was really clear on that. And that is going to finish in 18 months, and then everyone is going to move on. That was the deal. That is my job. Not to be a coach. If people cannot handle the Gary Nevilles and the criticisms of everything, we need to change the club. No, guys, I just want to say that I came here to be the manager of Manchester United, not to be the coach. And every department, the scouting department, the sport director needs to do their job. I will do mine for 18 months and then we move on.
And that was the last we ever saw of Ruben Amorim as Manchester United manager. Now, he did pop up again this morning out for a walk with his wife in a very snowy looking Manchester. And I've never seen a man look more happy. It's almost as if he was like, sack me or sack me. And he's got his wish today. Like, the breakdown in clarity here between the manager and head coach thing is quite spectacular. I mean, maybe this was right in front of our eyes all along. Like, if you go back through any of Ruben Amorim's old quotes, you can go back as far as November 2024, when he's talking about transfer policy, who's going to have the final say on transfer policy. He says, I am the manager, the head coach, and I have to choose the players. Like, it was staring us right in the face from 18 months ago, maybe now like 14 months ago, that this was an issue. There was some sort of breakdown. We didn't think it was going to become as big an issue as it did. But clearly Manchester United had one idea of what this guy's role was. Yeah. And Ruben Amorim had this deeply held belief that actually the reality was very different.
Do you think these things get lost in translation? So it's like you would call in other countries the what English football would call the manager, and Irish football would be called the head coach, would be called the coach. And, you know, I think maybe it's taken him until a showdown with Jason Wilcox on Friday to realise that what he thought he was and what Manchester United thought he was were two different things. Like, it could actually be as simple as that, and that's why he's gone with that. Like, because it was an amazing and explosive press conference, but it was very repetitive and, dare I say, like, somewhat incoherent. Like, what's he talking about? You know what I mean? He's saying the same thing over and over again, but I don't think we know what he's talking about. And I do wonder if this is something that he's like massively fixated on because of a conversation, a fight, by all accounts. A blow up, an incident between him and Wilcox that they had over their tactics for the Wolves game that they had on Friday, right before he did his press conference pre Leeds.
So, I guess the thing is it unreasonable if you're in Amorim's position that the sporting director, who you believe should be the guy out buying players, and ultimately the story seems to go that Wilcox has said they wouldn't be investing in January while Amorim felt they needed additional players, that Wilcox or one of the other Ineos appointees would turn around and say that you need to play football in a certain style?
Yeah. I wonder is the Gary Neville mention in that press conference suggestive of that? You know, if Gary Neville and the likes are criticising how the club play or how the team plays, and
the hierarchy
Manchester United are coming to Ruben Amorim to say that, basically, that we're getting criticised for how we're playing, I think if they're coming to him as a company, you know,
then
he's
screwed.
Well within his rights to tell them to F off there. Whether they accept that or not is their thing, but I'd be on his side in that. Whether it's the, you know, the, I don't know, there is a footballing element to somebody being over him as well and saying, your job kind of depends on this. This is not how we think we can play and win. I think that's a different thing. So I don't think we'll ever find out which of it it is. I'd say they would have both very different realities even. It's not a case of truth and lies either. You know what I mean? One would probably think it's coming from one place, the other would think it's coming from another.
So it feels like a fairly spectacular failure for Jim Ratcliffe particularly, because after the Grimsby game, he did a series of interviews and said that Ruben Amorim was going to require 3 years and that they were wedded to him as the right guy to be in charge and that they trusted him and they trusted the process for it to improve. Like, in theory, particularly over the last 6 or 7 games, Manchester United have improved, and he's in a position where they're just outside the top 5, which is going to be a Champions League place. You would argue this is probably the best period of Ruben Amorim's time in charge over the last 14 months, and they're sacking him from that position, which would indicate that obviously they didn't have full faith in him. And also, their previous sporting director, who is Dan Ashworth, didn't want Ruben Amorim to be in charge, and they cautioned against appointing him and wanted Gareth Southgate. And eventually he would fall, despite the fact that Ineos had spent so long waiting for him to become available and then paying Newcastle a chunk of money to get him out of his contract as well. So it all seems like a complete lack of joined up thinking when you go back to Erik ten Hag being offered an extra time in charge because of winning the FA Cup when it seemed like they were about to fire him as well. Like, I don't know. To me, from the outside, this looks like Ineos have made a succession of mistakes and they're now following another one up by, again, getting rid of a manager who they probably should have got rid of before this if the style was the problem.
I think Ratcliffe cooled on Amorim as the last 12 months went on. He described him early in his tenure as an outstanding young manager. And the interview that you talk about last year with the Sunday Times business podcast, he actually says he needs to prove that he's a great manager over 3 years. He didn't say we are going to give him 3 years. He says he needs to prove he's a great manager over 3 years, which we all kind of took as, you know, oh, he's going to give him sort of, because I think he brought up Arteta in that interview as well. And talked about a lack of winning things, and everybody sort of like used that template as a, oh, he's going to get patience. But I think if you compare those two things, Ratcliffe had possibly changed his tune in terms of how effusive he was going to be in his praise. That is not to say that Jim Ratcliffe knows what he's doing, by the way.
And well, is your interpretation that he would have to prove himself over a sustained 3-year period as opposed to over the next 3 years he needs to prove himself?
Yeah.
They're two different things.
Like, Ruben needs to demonstrate he is a great coach over 3 years, is the exact quote.
The spin coming from Manchester United, so I say Mark Ogden had sources in the club who described Amorim as immature, and I think Caveh from Sky Sports said that he was too emotional. Again, that was coming from the club. So, you know, they're very similar, you know, ideas, and you do wonder if that's like, if that kind of thing, above all, above what's happening on the football pitch, is what brings forward a decision. You know, so maybe Ratcliffe has cooled on him, Owen, but is he also, you know, does something happen that makes me think, oh, I don't know about this guy. If he's not in control of this situation, he's not our guy. You know, they start talking about what age, you know, he's 40, he's 39 when he got the job. You know, maybe he's not ready for something like this. Obviously, it's a massive step up as well from Sporting to Manchester United. We have to start talking about things like that and whether they work. I also think what you're talking about with Ineos there, it's all very, like, don't forget, like, the two of the biggest teams of the Premier League have blown everything up in the last week. You know, and they've, for very similar reasons. And Maresca obviously got to the point where he felt belittled and he felt like he was being put in a position of being almost like the level of a baseball manager, you know, which we all know from Moneyball, not the most respected person in the clubhouse always. I don't know how true that always is, but you know, if you just take that, like, you know, that's basically the feeling Maresca has. Feels like Amorim's that way as well. And this is going to be the case with private equity ownership. They are going to more and more and more treat football clubs as the same as their businesses and not as sporting clubs that are as much about community as they are about business, as much about sporting performance as financial performance, and so on. And I think this is going to end up being a constant issue over the next few years.
Hey everybody, it's Off The Ball's Gerry Gilroy here. Now, before you dive into this podcast, let me tell you that William Hill have decided racing needed a bit of a shake-up. So they've brought in the new Racing Bet Builder. It lets you combine multiple picks from the same race into one personalised bet. Basically, more options, more control, and fewer excuses if your mate's bet beats yours. Pick top three finishes, go head-to-head, or call exact positions all in a single bet. It's racing from a new angle, and it's live now with William Hill. Get the app, start building your bet today. It's over 18s only. Gamble responsibly. Visit gamblingcare.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Like, I also think that, as you point out,
the changing on Ashworth is like a real black mark against Ineos, and also Ten Hag backing him to the hilts last summer and then backing him again last September and then sacking him when clearly he wasn't the right guy. A disastrous move. So you put all these things together and they're absolutely going to be in the firing line, possibly even more so than the Glazers for Manchester United fans at this point, that Ineos are going to be under the microscope because they have made a complete mess of this thing. And
haven't the Glazers pulled a blinder in all this though, whereby more money comes into the club, but Ineos have to take complete responsibility for what happens on the footballing side, and the Glazers get to sit in Fort Lauderdale and enjoy their money.
And probably make the final call on Amrum this morning without anybody giving them the credit or the blame for actually making the call. So, yeah, like, and I mean, when it comes to who's going to be next, you might actually bring us in here again on what actually is the next step before we discuss actually where Manchester United might look to next.
Yeah, so Darren Fletcher's going to be in charge Wednesday. They go to Burnley in the Premier League. Early speculation, though, is that United are going to appoint an interim boss till the end of this season who is not Fletcher, which will give them time then to get a permanent appointment.
Ralf Ragnick.
Yeah, I can imagine it's not a chance he's going back. Like Michael,
he's the Austria manager, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He get ready for the World Cup. But like Michael Carrick would seem the one that's been the most linked at the moment. He's out of work since he left Middlesbrough. Did a decent job when he was interim Manchester United boss the last time. I'm sure they will just get a former player to step in until the end of the season. But United's plan reportedly is Oliver Glasner, another manager who plays three at the back. He's out of contract end of the summer. And in recent weeks, he made it fairly clear he's not going to sign a contract extension at Palace. So they're apparently their long-term.
If they want Glasner and Glasner wants it, why not just get him now?
Will Crystal Palace let him go now is the only thing.
Well, of course they will. If they're going to lose him in the summer anyway and they'll give him 5 million or whatever, they will. Like, yeah.
Yeah, that would appear to make
form at the moment as well. It's not to say that's like not something that they can turn around, but if it becomes more and more obvious the manager's off to Manchester United in the summer, they're better off doing it now. Like.
Unless there's some sort of, you know, reluctance to appoint a manager who has recently been fairly critical of his own club as well in terms of their own transfer dealings last summer. I'd be less worried about the three at the back. He's said that 4-4-2 is his favourite formation. Not that 4-4-2 should be anybody's formation in this day and age of football either.
Manchester United,
but
wingers.
He's a three at the back because that's the squad he inherited at Crystal Palace, allegedly. So that's where he goes.
To be fair to Glasner, he's always proven that he's a bit more adaptable than that. He's not the type of guy who goes like Amrum a month ago who said, not even the Pope can convince me to change my style. Effectively, Glasner has said, I will go into a club, I will look at the squad and I will pick what works. So presumably he'd play differently.
When we're lost in the kind of intricacies of a very interesting story here as to what's actually happened, I don't know if we've actually even thought about whether Amorim's been hard done by or whether this is the right decision by United. I would have thought like after the Grimsby game, it was over. Yeah. I just felt like there's no way back from this. And in fairness to him, it's not that they've massively even improved or that they're all that much better, but he did like stem that. You know, the idea that this was an imminent thing has been gone for a couple of months now. And they did have a decent run. Not great performances, though. I did find that they were almost looking for a little bit like the 4-4 with Bournemouth and the defeat to Villa in the same week. Got a huge amount of praise, you know, for 1 point and 6 goals conceded. I think Roy Keane was the only one who was like, hey, excuse me, what are you all talking about? And then since then, it's gone, like, with obviously a horrible week this week. So I didn't see him turning Manchester United into title winners or, you know, that even incrementally. So I don't know if this is the wrong decision for United either, just because it all happened in a kind of a mad way. I don't know if we need to, you know, just because the process wasn't bad doesn't mean the result is,
and
or wasn't good.
There's also a chance that the truth is that he was going to be out the door regardless of what he said at the weekend, because that is one of the messages being put out there by the football club at the moment, and because it's the leakiest club in the world and the club with the most relationships with journalists, we get a lot of different reports. And certainly what they want to put out there is that what he said yesterday has no bearing. It's down to results, and you can actually absolutely look at that and say that's fine, but would a good season for Manchester United this year be qualifying for the Champions League? Absolutely it would be, and they're still very much on track to contend for that at the end of the season.
I think because the way the top five race is looking at the moment as well, it's become essential for them to qualify now this season, whereby the opportunity is there for them to do so. There's been such kind of middling form of the teams between about 4th and 10th that Manchester United, if they were to go on a reasonable run, should qualify, which is one of the reasons that they can't really afford to write this season off. Like if you look at last year where it was a run in Europe but the Premier League was entirely lost and they were out of the other competitions, you could argue you could almost tank and just put everything into Europe. In this this case, Manchester United have to have a decent second half of the season to qualify for the Champions League. I don't think winning the FA Cup, if it was to happen under a caretaker, would be enough for them. They need to try and get back into the Champions League. So they can't afford to just kind of let this season drift out now.
They're also like in a position where things have been so bad now for so long that they are not the club they once were. They might be in terms of size and support base, but I don't think people are going to take the chance of them. I don't think it's the job you can't turn down anymore. And I think because of that, there's a, like, United need to go and get someone who's proven and that they know is the man. There's about five of them in the world. Who's taking the United job? And especially when the last manager leaves because he's been undermined and told that he basically has no responsibilities other than picking the team. Even the tactics are questioned. So take Emery. A lot, like, United fans seem to want him. That's a lot. There's an assumption there that I think is fair. I'm not even giving out about it as a Villa fan. There's a fair assumption there that, like, if United come calling, off he goes. Except I don't think that's the case, because he's in a position where the most important thing to him as a manager is that everything runs through him and it's a funnel that he has total control. And I don't think he can have that at Manchester United, and I think he knows he can't. So why go and leave a perfect situation for something that he can't control, whether it's failure or success? And I think there's a lot of managers out there, and I think a lot of the best guys that are already established, who I think is what United need, are going to really have to think twice. Whereas I think 10 years ago, when we were still kind of early post-Fergie, it's like, this is the giant that I can, Mourinho at his peak would have went to United. Absolutely. I don't know if that's the case anymore.
It would be funny if Darren Fletcher plays 3-4-3 against Burnley now on Thursday. It's just like,
well, it puts the two young lads on the pitch. See what happens.
Our number is 0879-180-180, by the way, if you want to get us on WhatsApp. Patrick says, it seems to me that the board of directors at Manchester United are bothered more by the manager speaking out against them than they are about on-field performances. Meanwhile, Barry says, the Amorim sacking was proper Monday morning decisiveness. Most people hadn't even turned off their out-of-office replies. And then Brendan says, looks like it was the last straw in an ongoing power struggle between Amorim and the powers that be. Team setup was a major factor, changed a winning team against Newcastle to draw the next two matches. United are blessed to be where they are on the table, not great against average teams, and a stinker of a fixture list upcoming. No confidence in them to win any game, which maybe is the real reason why Ruben Amorim is no longer Manchester United manager. Will, take us on to Celtic, because they've also parted ways with their boss.
Yeah, so Wilfred Nancy is gone. The former Columbus Crew manager was just in charge for 8 games in the end. He lost 6 of those matches. The run included defeats in the Scottish League Cup final against St Mirren, and also that game against Rangers in the Old Firm derby on Saturday. His 3 assistants will also leave the club, and also falling on his sword, the head of football operations, Paul Tisdale, who was pretty key to appointing Nancy as manager as well. He has been sacked today as well. Not been announced just yet who will be taking over, but speculation is rife that Martin O'Neill will be handed a third spell in charge at Parkhead. And among those who are calling for him, I had Rod Stewart, just before he came on air, put out a social media video saying it's Martin O'Neill's time to come back.
Yeah. He's not wrong.
But Rod says, goes, why is he not running the club?
Rod knows his onions.
I don't think Rod was one of the fans left at Parkhead when the game was finishing at the weekend as well. It was kind of a bizarre sight when you looked at the stands and they were more than half empty on Saturday afternoon. I think Rod was gone too.
It's the most obvious thing in the world to give it Martin to the end of the season.
Well, that's again, if Martin O'Neill is interested in taking it.
You best believe he is.
Just on a very, very interim basis again, with no chance of getting the job.
I don't know. I think if Dermot Desmond says you've got 10 minutes to make up your mind, you're saying till the end of the season, Martin O'Neill's up the road on the way back to Celtic again.
The funny thing is, like, he'd absolutely still win the league.
Yeah.
You know, and I know it's another league or whatever, but it is the only thing that matters at the moment, so... Whatever about United not being able to give up the season, Celtic certainly can't either, you know, so.
It does feel quite remarkable that Rangers have actually got level on points to them at this stage. When you consider the 2 month advantage that they gave away at the start of the season, and now Celtic have hit such a terrible run of form that they've now been caught up with, and even where Hearts have had a couple of shaky results over the last while, they're still 6 points clear of Celtic, because Celtic have also messed up their game in hand, so.
Rangers aren't even that good. Like, from their form isn't even great. They're still likely to drop points against the St Mirrens and Dundees and Dundee Uniteds of the world, etc. But as that game got away from them on Saturday, you're thinking, right, okay, this Amorim coming in today to deal with on a Monday, surprising. Nancy, no, not surprising.
I just want to say good evening to our listener Dermot Desmond. Celtic confirmed Martin O'Neill as manager until the end of the season.
Ah.
He will be supported by Sean Maloney and Mark Fotheringham as assistants, reports Ben Jacobs. So Sky also running with that on their ticker at the moment. It's been a hell of a day for the yellow ticker in Sky Sports News.
It has, although I did find it funny that they alternated the Darren Fletcher news as breaking news at about 6 o'clock, and they're going, I think that was in the statement this morning, lads. I'm not sure this is actually breaking news, but they were lucky. Obviously the Nancy thing happened after that. The thing, and we'll get Tom English's opinion on this a bit later in the show as well, I just wonder why they didn't keep O'Neill in charge for maybe 3 or 4 more games after that spell that was there, because they knew there was a rocky period of fixtures coming up and the League Cup final. It seemed really strange a few days out from a Cup final to actually bring a new manager in, especially when you knew that new manager was going to play a different style of football. I wonder if it could have been slightly different if they had said, O'Neill, if you can do us a favour, stay in charge until whatever it was, 3rd of January, until after the Rangers game, and we're going to bring a new coach in at that point. But Celtic obviously decided their own way.
We have covered there the two Sky Sports News ticker stories of the day. The departure of Ruben Amorim, the departure of Wilfred Nancy, and it seems the breaking news that Martin O'Neill will be back at Parkhead until the end of the season. There was loads of other sport over the course of the weekend, so we're going to take a break and we'll come back to that in the second part.
Hey everybody, it's Off The Ball, it's Gerard Gilroy. Now, before you dive into this podcast, there are plenty of ways to build an ACCA. Some people stick with the favourites, some are convinced they've cracked it, others less sure once the final result goes sideways. However you do it, William Hill lets you boost your football ACCA, giving you more back when it comes good. Just build the ACCA you want with 4 or more legs and William Hill will boost your winnings depending on the number of selections. The boost is applied automatically and shown right there in your bet slip, so you know exactly what you're getting. Whether it's a quiet midweek fixture or a big weekend of football, it's a simple way to get more out of every ACCA you place. Download the app or visit William Hill to get started today. Over 18s only. Gamble responsibly. Visit gamblingcare.ie. Now, back to the podcast.
You're welcome back to Monday Night's Off The Ball. The breaking news you were just showing us is that Martin O'Neill is back in charge of Celtic until the end of the season. So it's going to be his second spell as interim boss in the one season. How many people have been interim boss in the one season twice?
Ooh.
I mean, that'd be as Gus Hiddink had that honor. Feels like something he might have been.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Quiz question out there.
Ryan Mason.
Ryan Mason might have done something like that.
Maybe it was just 4 seasons in a row or something with him.
He's out of work at the moment as well, if they do need another interim head coach.
So it's going to be Sean Maloney and Mark Fotheringham going in as his assistants.
His statement is out here, by the way.
Okay.
Martin O'Neill says, I'm really pleased, in fact, very honoured to be back to manage the team again. I'm looking forward to getting back to work again with the players. I know we'd have loved for things to have worked out differently under Wilfred. I personally want to wish him good luck with everything he does in the game. He's a fine man and I'm sure he'll go on to achieve success again. I have no doubt.
I do feel sorry.
So I saw
it. I have to say, it becomes a farcical situation and you can look at it from afar as this like comedy moment, and like to an extent it is, but there's also a person at the center of it, like, who, you know, it just didn't work out, you know. It's Celtic are having a tough enough time anyway, you know. It wasn't the most ideal situation to walk into in the middle of. So
will the scientific community welcome Venn diagrams back into the fold again, or has irreparable damage been done to them as a format? I wonder. Wish him well in his future endeavours. Will O'Callaghan, where do you want to take us next?
I'm just going to give you the AFCON game, which is finished. They went to extra time. So Mo Salah scored a penalty late on in extra time for Egypt. They've beaten Benin 3-1. So they've now qualified for the quarterfinals of the competition. Premier League on the pitch across the weekend, away from the sackings. Man City boss Pep Guardiola said his side were extraordinary in all departments, despite drawing 1-1 against Chelsea. They conceded a 94th minute equaliser to lose ground in the Premier League title race. They're now 6 points off the leaders Arsenal, who won at Bournemouth on Saturday. Liverpool went ahead in stoppage time to Cody Gakpo, but couldn't hold on as they were pegged back 2-2 by Fulham. I think Harrison Reed's goal probably up there for the Puskas Award this year, who was just on the pitch. Nathan Collins was on target as Brentford secured a 4-2 victory against Everton, while Newcastle beat Crystal Palace 2-0. Aston Villa's 3-1 victory at Nottingham Forest saw them climb up to second. They're level on points with City as things stand. Burnley's winless run is now 11 games as they lost 2-0 against Brighton. And bottom side Wolves finally won a game 20 matches into the season as they hammered fellow strugglers West Ham 3-0. West Ham against Forest tomorrow.
Brilliant weekend of football, actually. It's been completely overshadowed by, as you say, off-field matters. It's kind of hard to know what's the most interesting story, particularly from an Irish standpoint, because the Brentford win yesterday was just absolutely unbelievable. And the Igor Thiago, I know he hadn't scored in a few, but he just looks like another piece of brilliant Brentford business. I mean, Manchester City slipping against Chelsea yesterday, Arsenal going 6 points clear, but as you say, Wolves finally winning and winning comprehensively, another mad aspect of a mad weekend.
It feels like it's been coming, and West Ham are in big trouble. We might talk to Ben about it at some stage over the course of the few days. But for me, Liverpool, Liverpool were shocking yesterday, I thought, you know, and
even worse against Liverpool.
I don't understand, and I would love to see, maybe I've missed something today, but I don't understand how the Wirtz goal was given. It was very, very clearly offside. And, you know, that is what it is, but it didn't feel like a goal was coming at that stage, you know. So they obviously, I think there was somewhat justice that it would have been real smash and grab for them to win the game. And obviously it was an unbelievable goal again. So there was like, it was that sort of, it became a very dramatic last 20 minutes of that game. We were kind of waiting for City and Chelsea, and then City and Chelsea was kind of a bit dull.
It was very, I've just won 3 points for my team, celebrations from Cody Gakpo.
I know.
And he was saying afterwards, I hadn't even sat down when Reid scored the goal.
Yeah, he went and put on his jacket. And
himself and Slatt were just like, you just have to hand it to him. It was an absolutely unbelievable goal. And it is goal of the season, I think. Isn't it?
So far, yeah.
It's superb. Yeah. But I just think that there's on a day of sackings, like, Liverpool aren't getting much better, and the results have got better. And again, I thought it seemed like they'd won that game. And there's something to be said for that, by the way. Like, you know, there is something to be said for scoring in the last minute. And Liverpool did it a good bit last season on their way to the title and so on.
First five games this year, yeah.
But it's just poor performance after poor performance. And, you know, they're up to fourth. They're in a decent position to go and, like, salvage the season by being in the Champions League. But you have to start questioning, it's like, what are they, like, if, it's not just about where they finish. I think it's got to be about how they finish the season as to whether Slot even. I don't think he's not antagonizing everybody at the club in the way, you know, Amrum and Maresca were. So I don't think they're going to have to, I don't think they're going to have to jump the gun on it or anything. But I'd say they're seriously thinking about the summer at the moment.
Yeah, style of football is really poor. They got booed by their own fans on Thursday with the draw against Leeds. You couldn't blame them. The style of football is very pedestrian. It's very slow. They tend to get the ball back to the fullback. Fullback tries to swing across in. Like, heavy metal football is very much in the rearview mirror now at this stage. So I think Liverpool fans have expected a certain style of football, and that's not there. And then when you take Mo Salah out, you also no longer have that idea of just get the ball to Mo or Trent to play a diagonal ball, which maybe will get Liverpool up the field. That's not happening. And teams have loads of time to reset now. And like, Leeds sat reasonably deep, but were very comfortable. Just kind of pulled their two centre-backs in, waited for the cross to come in, cleared it. And Liverpool didn't look like they were going to create a chance all night.
Yeah,
really poor.
Maybe missing Ekotike as well was a big factor for Liverpool as well. Yesterday's been their best attacker all season, I think. Let's move on to the rugby then. We've got Monday Night Rugby coming up after 8 o'clock. But what's been happening today in terms of headlines, Will?
Yeah, so Leinster announced their injury update this afternoon. The good news for them is that Robbie Henshaw is back for their game against La Rochelle in the Investec Champions Cup on Saturday. That's live here on News Talk. The Ireland centre have been sidelined since injuring his finger in the URC Champions win against Munster last month. Also, Gary Ringrose and Orgie Snyman back in training with the province, while a decision will be made on Harry Byrne and Rabah Slimani's availability later in the week. Byrne was a late withdrawal ahead of Leinster's crushing 52-17 defeat of Connacht on Saturday night. He had a calf issue, but Leo Cullen said after the game that it's not that severe. Looks like Byrne could be Ireland's first choice for the Six Nations. Certainly the reports in quite a few of the papers, and now he's gone ahead of Sam Prendergast as well. Connacht face a real uphill task to finish in the top eight in the United Rugby Championship. Head coach Stuart Lancaster hinted after the game at rotating his squad for the upcoming Challenge Cup matches where they play against Montpellier and Montauban.
We've asked a lot of certain players and we've got a good group of players who want an opportunity. So, yeah, it works both ways for us. You know, it's if we can get points away in Montpellier and certainly at Montauban, we should qualify, which is one of our goals. We're definitely not out of the top eight race. You know, I know that from my experience both at Leinster and in France as well. You know, you fight to the end and every point counts. We didn't get a point today. And we'll dust ourselves down and learn the lessons, but then we'll come back and fight again against Leinster. Then we've got Zebra, the end of the block. We've got the game in hand against Scarlets, which is to be at home. So those games will be huge games for us in the second half of the season.
Leinster, they're winning that game, so now 7 in a row for them. While Connacht are in a horrific run in Interpros, they've lost 11 in succession. Ulster up to third place in the United Rugby Championship. Second half tries from Jake Flannery, Bryn Ward and Tom Stewart helped them beat Munster on Friday night at Ravenhill by 28 points to 3. Nathan Doa kicking 13 points on the week where he signed a new contract, while Munster's points all coming from a JJ Hanrahan penalty. The Munster head coach Clayton McMillan couldn't hide his frustration after the game. He says they were far from good enough.
Yeah, there's no sugarcoating over anything, really. We just never got our game going. We never allowed to get our game going. And got to give credit to where it's due, and that's to a good Ulster side.
It's a tricky time of the year. There's rotations. There's so many big matches coming. Did you just feel it was maybe just a bit of lack of cohesion probably was the difference?
No, it just wasn't good enough. Nowhere near the standard that we want to set. It's an opportunity for a number of people to put themselves in the jersey in the coming weeks and really just walk away with more questions than answers. So, not a great day at the office, but as coaches, we own it first and foremost. I think we've been a little clunky in our performances, haven't quite hit our stride. We've tried a few different things, obviously haven't struck the right chord just yet. So, it starts with us. We'll go away, we'll reflect on what we can do better. We've got an 8-9 day turnaround now, so we really need to leverage off that to try and find the solutions.
I wouldn't suggest Munster training is the cheeriest place in Irish sport at the moment. We've heard this interview from Clayton McMillan two or three times this season, really, where he's not making any bones about the fact that his team are falling way short of his expectations. He was also saying that his team seems to have an ability to get up for, you know, the glamour European ties or the Leinster games and not really find their pitch for an away trip to Ulster, which is a real criticism of his team's character.
Especially with Ulster and the form they're in as well. So I completely agree. I kind of have a certain level of trust, or certainly at least leeway, for McMillan at the moment to give it this season to really get to know things, because it's not the first time Munster have been a bit streaky as well. Like it feels like it's been the case for years. On the other side of things, like, it is genuinely brilliant to see Ulster being a force again. Like it got so bad over the last few years. Like, you know, they're not even in the Champions Cup this year. You know, so like Ulster being a force again can only be good for Irish rugby, and can only be good for like rugby up there as well, and general interest and everything like that. The one thing I'd say about this was, it was on up against the Darts the other night, like, yeah. And God, it was hard to watch. It was dull. And it's just, there's too many rugby games at the moment that I'm finding a chore to watch. And, you know, you can take, like, some people have an interest in sport, some people don't, whatever. But, like, for the people in between who kind of like every sport, and, like, I will watch Ulster and Munster whenever it's on, there's too many games I'm just finding really difficult to watch. The styles of play, the constant stoppages, the TMO, everything about it. It's taken far too long for games to complete. I am finding rugby really difficult this year.
It's also extremely hard to pick anything over the Darts. Because it is novel, even at the semi-final stage.
And it's quick. But I don't even mean that. What I mean is, though, that you're trying to sort of almost, I don't want to feel like watching any sport is out of a sense of duty. There was the Darts.
It should be
on
fun.
There, the thrilling thing, but it's like, I should be at least getting something out of it. Instead, I'm just getting this, like, especially the first half, just dour crap, really. Like, you know?
The first half went up against Littler hammering Ryan Searle, so I was able to make peace with, I'll watch a good bit of the rugby because it looks like Littler's going to ease through this. The second half was up against Van Veen against Anderson, which is one of the best matches we've ever seen at the World Championship. So, unfortunately, the second half drifted away.
You kind of tended to go towards the big screen.
My only concern at that stage was, are Ulster going to get a bonus point? I'm not really that pushed. I think I'll watch the Darts fully.
We will have news about the Premier League and Darts in just a moment, but let's move on to Gaelic Games, Will, because it's going to be St Bridget's and Dingle in the All-Ireland Club Football Final.
Yep, should be a really good game in Croke Park in 2 weeks' time. So Roscommon's Bridget's into their second decider in three seasons, a 116-112 win against Scotstown at Breffni Park yesterday. Bobby Nugent started the show, 7 points. Brian Derwin with the goal in the first half for the 2013 American Cup winners. They'll be hoping the key defender Brian Stack is okay. He had a very heavy fall during the game yesterday. Bridget's boss Anthony Cunningham managed Gary Castle to victory against his adopted club Bridget's back in 2012 in the semi-finals. He's now taken another team in green and red to the final, and he told our own Tommy Rooney that that's a special moment.
It's great to be in a final, and the All-Ireland Club Final is, you know, really, really important day in the calendar for every club in the country, so we're just happy to be there, and hopefully, you know, we can improve a bit more for the next day and, you know, give a good account of ourselves. Some dangling is probably going to be difficult, but let's see what happens.
Happy to be there. Special to be there in All-Ireland Club Final Day. Bridges have been there and they've won it. They've been there and they've lost it. You've been there with Gary Castle and you lost after a replay across McGlynn.
That's right.
So there's a lot of work to do in the next 2 weeks to get the job done.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, these guys definitely were, you know, very much driven, disappointed, you know, for a couple of years ago there that they lost out to Glen and Derry, and a match that they could have won. And, you know, they're a very driven group, and it's not just the 15 you see today. We have a very, very strong panel. We have 30 players there that work extremely hard, and there's probably some of them really disappointed that are, you know, unfortunate maybe, and hard luck not to be playing as well. So for us, yeah, they drive it really, and the players are top class.
Paul Gainey was very much Dingle's hero in the other semi-final. So the injured All-Star forward scored 8 points after being sprung from the bench, including a two-pointer which sent the game to extra time as the Kerry champions overcame Ballyboden St Enda's by 126-124 at Porkycueve. Dingle had trailed at a stage by 10 points. Tom O'Sullivan very much stepping up as well. He got 6 points across the hour plus. They will now have to ask AFL club Geelong if they can keep Mark O'Connor for two more weeks as well.
Geelong are like, what?
Yeah, so he's only like, is he?
He said there's one more.
Is he coming back, is he?
I thought you said it was the best moment of your life 4 weeks ago. How can you have another moment that's an even better moment of your life?
Well, Paul Gainey spoke to Tommy after the game as well at Porkycueve, and he spoke particularly about taking the responsibility of that two-point shot late on in normal time.
There's 2 minutes to go, and Connor and yourself and Mark are in a pocket. Mm. I think maybe one of the other lads comes in, there's four or five Ballyboden defenders, yeah. Right, you're shipping it around. Brian on TG Carr commentary says, Tomish Nukik Tastal O'Dingle. Like, is it Mishnuk? Is it bravery? Like, what is it like when you turn on your right and then go back into your left?
A little bit, I think. I said to the boys there that I had a chance beforehand on the left, on the left pocket, like on my right leg, and I turned back in and I actually gave it to Mark in the back door, and we were point down at that stage, and Mark went for, I'd say, fatigue. He just threw the left leg at it, and the goalkeeper saved it. I probably thought that was our last chance, but I said, if I get one more chance here, I'm taking it. Like, I won't regret it.
There's no point probably asking you this, but like, you're nearly 1 foot in the county final. I think you scored 2-2. I know it affects you against the Bears late on. You come on today at half time and played extra time. How are you going to be fixed in 2 weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks is probably what I needed, just an extra 2 weeks. So hopefully that didn't do anything bad for me in that regard, and yeah, be good to go in 2 weeks now.
This was just absolutely stupid, really. This afternoon, really, in Porkycueve, I actually spent New Year's down in West Kerry, so Dingle on New Year's Eve, Ventry on New Year's Day, and just a palpable sense of both of the clubs, Dingle and Onghaeltacht, and what was coming at the weekend. Weirdly, none of the players were out drinking. I was like, where are all the players? But like, what are they doing? I mean, training for this like life-defining moment, and for them to both win in outrageous circumstances is just a pretty incredible day for West Kerry all round. Obviously, a bit of controversy at the end of the Gaeltacht game against Salins, and then one of the best comebacks you're ever likely to see in club football in the Dingle game, because Ballyboden were favoured by a lot of people. They like had been justifiable favourites going into this game. I was driving back up to Dublin for the first half, so kind of was consuming it through Radio Kerry on the internet radio, and there was like a sense of resignation from the first kick of the ball. Paul Gainey's injured, he's not here, how are they going to do it without Paul Gainey? And then to go 10 points down, it's like, this thing is completely over. But can they show some fight? Can they put some pride in the badge? So to actually win it from that place is, as I say, just stupid. Like, the Mark O'Connor thing is one thing that you've mentioned there, but it's actually, they've got two players back from Australia, the single team. Gavin Curran, the goalkeeper, will be an Australian resident soon because his partner is giving birth out in Australia, but he returned or stayed at home during this very important time for his family to tug out for Dingle. So will he also get the opportunity to tug out in Croke Park in 2 weeks' time? Time will tell.
Well, it just shows you how important it all is. It was one of the most, it was such a good game of football, and I don't know about you, some people do and some people don't. I find winter GA, just that it just takes me that extra little bit to get into it. I'd want to be hooked into a game, you know, it's like the choice of, and this was just all consuming because it felt like the longest comeback of all time as well, because like Ballyboden were way ahead and Dingle were like constantly on the attack, constantly clawing at it, but Ballyboden were getting quick scores to just stay ahead, and when they did get the two-pointer to go to extra time, Paddy Bowden got a free then, and Colin Pascal, who's been brilliant for the whole game, you know, has a free. Now, it wasn't an easy free by any means, but it was also a soft free, and I think it would have been a horrible enough way to end it. You know, it's not to say to which team should have won, but if that would have been last kick of the game, and I think it would have been a much less story, I think, a much less of a story if Pascal nails that point. But everything about it was just so dramatic. It was everything you want.
But I do kind of feel sorry for Mark O'Connor in this, because he obviously has to go to his employer to ask for permission. So they find themselves in a county final back in the October bank holiday, and he's saying, genuinely, this would be the highlight of my like GAA related sports life if we were to win this game. And as I say a moment ago, like it's not even a joke. He then has to go back and say, sorry, actually, this would be the biggest moment of my entire life if we were to win this Munster Championship. Mm. And then he's got to go back again and say, no, sorry, this would genuinely be the biggest moment of my sport. And now next week would genuinely be the best moment
of his. All the while was getting deeper and deeper into pre-season for Geelong, where it's probably unacceptable at this
time. I think exactly, it says a lot about what they think of him, though, and how highly they think of him. Because if he was a Joe Soap on the edge of the roster, I don't think he'd be getting this leeway.
No. No, it's very true.
I'm happy, you know.
Mm.
In terms of the camogie then, Athenry are All-Ireland club champions.
They are. Their second title, Clodagh Burke's point, and then that insurance-free and injury time from Jessica Gill gave the Galway champions a 14-12 win against Cork St. Finbarrs in the replay at a frosty Semple Stadium on Saturday evening. The Barrs will definitely look back to the first game at Croke Park where they've been 6 points up. Therese Donoghue-Niemeyer was incredible, rolled back the years again. A huge performance from her, and she spoke to her own Rachel Sheehan after the game.
I'm frozen now, but absolutely delighted.
What was it like out there?
When we got here initially, the ground, there was no bounce on the ball at all when we were doing the walkthrough. And it's funny, I played on the far side in the first half and the underfoot wasn't too bad, but this side, the ground was hard. It was hard pick. There was no bounce at all on it. But look, it was the same for both sides.
Yeah, it didn't seem like that though. Like there was a real flow to the game. It wasn't stop start. From the get-go, like you could see there was still nothing between the two of you.
No, look, and that was evident the whole way through the game. I think they were 2 points as good last week, or 3 weeks ago. We were 2 points as good at half-time and probably had a few chances. We were creating opportunity, but probably had a few that went astray. But look, we were happy enough at half-time, but we certainly knew they were going to come back at us and they were going to have their purple patch, and that they did.
We've got a couple of young fellas running around you here trying to be like man.
They're certainly enjoying it anyway.
Oh, man! And yeah, obviously the Bears kind of take control then. They score 5 points on answer, but you come back again.
Yeah, look, and I think that's the way it was in both games. You know, we always knew they were going to have their purple patch and they're a fantastic team and they went 4 points to the good. But I suppose us, and more than them, there's always a fight in the team. And once we got the first point and then it was all about the next ball and maybe try win the next one and get the next score. And once we levelled, it was going to be anybody's game really. And look, I'm just delighted the momentum swung with us.
Yeah, that's Therese Donoghue-Niemeyer speaking to Rachel Sheehan after the Camogie final.
Played on ice. By the looks of things, it was weird.
Well, half the pitch, certainly covered in white anyway. Let's skip on to the darts. Well, I know there's loads of other stuff going on with pre-season GAA competitions and all that. We might come back to that a little bit later on, but we should talk about the darts and Luke Littler saying he wants to dominate the world.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to deny him? But this is, the teenager became just the fourth player to win the PDC title in back-to-back years. He's joined a club of Phil Taylor, Adrian Lewis and Gary Anderson. Anderson was a decade ago. Two Sid Waddell trophies. It means that only Taylor and Michael van Gerwen have won more. He recovered from losing the first set to hammer the Dutch rising star Jan van Veen 7-1 in the final at the Alexandra Palace on Saturday night. Littler averaged just over 106 in the match. The 18-year-old who sat down today says it's extra special to join that elite club of consecutive champions.
Yeah, it's special to join them greats on that great list. It's amazing, and we've put so much hard work in. Obviously, the longer tournament, we've definitely felt it. It's been a long tournament, but we've came out on top. I'd say it's underappreciated, but then again, I'm just doing my job. This is all I wanted to do. I'm going to get better. I'm going to keep practicing, hopefully more titles to come in 2026.
Littler, meanwhile, is going to be, I guess, no great surprise in the new Premier League dart season. He will be joined by the man he beat in Saturday's final, Van Veen, and fellow debutant Josh Rock from Antrim. Luke Humphreys, Michael van Gerwen, Johnny Clayton, Stephen Bunting and Gerwin Price complete the selection for the weekly tournament. And Gary Anderson, despite the fact he'd gone back inside the world's top eight, had been fairly clear he was not going to play. So that means Josh Rock gets in.
As you mentioned earlier, Will, the Van Veen-Anderson matchup was probably the moment of the World Championships, but really the one that might be remembered the longest is Luke Littler and his post-match comments after the Rob Cross encounter. That for me was
the
most fascinating moment of Littler's career to date, actually, was
because he lost the head so much.
Luke Littler turning heel.
Yeah.
And like investigating the sequence of events that we get to this point. Like it seems to have been explained away very simply as the crowd wanting the underdog to win. Is that it? Are we accepting that?
I don't know. I think that's true to an extent. But I think the more the Littler wins, the more the Littler can expect that he's probably going to be booed, especially if games goes one-sided as this. Well, you saw the World Final, and again, people can't doubt his brilliance at different times. Frickin' took out the big fish on the third set when it looked like the game might slip away from him. And then you're there, you've paid your money to go to a World Darts Final, and you watch a guy sweep at 7-1. And if it's like he's so far ahead, you're naturally going
to
hit him.
Does the bar close when the thing ends? So you naturally want every game to go on longer. Is that why the people... I don't understand the booing of someone great. Should we not be trying to... if you're going to boo somebody, and I'm not saying to do this, but should you not be booing the guy who has underperformed in the final, which is the true I know I'm not saying to do that, but like if you're picking one or the other, who am I going to boo? The guy who is this absolute sensation, who is playing the best darts we've seen since Phil Taylor, or are we going to boo the guy who has actually is the real reason why this is no contest, because he's not as good as the other fella?
But that was the last 16 game, and it was the last time he did have a contest, and he reacted. I don't know how bad the booing was. I was watching that game live, and it was a bit, they were getting excited for Cross. It's the last game of the night. They're there all day. You know, there's a bit of messing going on, let's say, you know, and Littler just kind of, it was getting to him, like, and he flipped, and it's because he's 18 and it's the first time he's ever dealt with it, and he overreacted. And I think he was trying to be funny from a hurt place, and it came across terrible. But we thought, oh, well, now he's just going to get it constantly. But he didn't really. In all fairness, he wasn't really out there very much, because he won the quarterfinal 5-0. He won the semifinal 6-1. He won the final 7-1.
Yeah.
Losing the first set both times. Like, it just...
The booing
his level is gone to an extreme, like, improvement even from last year.
Yeah.
Like, where he's playing now is, like... unheard of darts.
Like, he won 5 majors ultimately this season, and then won the Worlds at the end of it as well. So I think if he doesn't throw a dart between now and the PDC next year, he's still world number one, because he's more than £1.7 million ahead, and it's money as opposed to ranking points now at this stage. So he's just in an incredible position. But it's funny, there was theatrics when it came to the booing before the Ratajski game, but Pitbull was enough to kill the booing. Once Pitbull started, people were singing along. And then there was some kind of faint boos just after that. But then they had, there's only one Luke Littler, and we're living in a Littler wonderland, and all this type of stuff afterwards. So,
all the clever songs.
Well, I do understand the concept of a darts crowd. Like, I mean, Stand Up If You Love the Darts is the song. It's not Stand Up If You Love Player X or Player Y. So having darts and having a great volume of darts is the MO of being in a darts crowd. And because you have one dominant force, you are going to have a smaller volume of darts, because he's just going to kill everybody 7-1, 7-2. So I understand that. But don't boo the guy. We've got to be building this guy up. We should be celebrating this guy. We shouldn't be tearing this guy down. He's been absolutely sensational.
Yeah, I don't think it was done that much, though. And I think he overreacted. You know, so
it was very the reaction was very funny.
It was very funny. Yeah. Like,
I'm not bothered. Well, there was steam coming out of his ears when he was saying, "I'm not bothered."
He was born the year after or the year before. Forgive me, I'm not 100% sure that the Catherine Tate show ended.
Wow.
So I'm not even sure if he knows too much.
Well,
about,
I'm not bothered. Character.
David Wilson, who was at Ali Pally. The bar does close even before the end of the last game at Ali Pally, unfortunately. There's a man who comes with a lot of December regrets. He was there in one of the early rounds. Thank you for that, David. We're going to take one last break. We'll bring you a couple of more stories after the break. Remember, Monday Night Rugby coming up after 8, and a football show reacting to one of the craziest days in recent memory in the footballing world after 9 o'clock. Back in a few.
Off the Ball Daily.